sometimes it's difficult to really grasp some of the concepts that we hear about all the time. Like broadband. What exactly does that mean? Should we use U.S. standards or those of South Korea or Europe or Japan's measurements? They're all different. And the global broadband economy. What exactly does that mean? Is it doing business from free Wi-Fi in the city's parks? Or is it more than that? And how is our region doing? How do we measure up? This interview with Robert Bell, the Executive Director of the Intelligent Community Forum, will answer those questions and more. In part one of this interview, Mr. Bell explains some of the concepts, politics, challenges, and opportunities to the broadband economy.
Coming to you from the world-renowned Magnum Building on beautiful Payne Avenue in the heart of Cleveland, Ohio, it's the entrepreneur himself, Dan Hansen, bringing you the Great Lakes Geek Show.
All right, we're speaking with Robert Bell, the Executive Director of the Intelligent Community Forum. Robert, let's start off. What is the Intelligent Community Forum?
We are a think tank, so we sit around thinking big thoughts. And the things we think big thoughts about, Billy, are how communities can use information technology and broadband to build very competitive, very inclusive economies in really kind of a strange world, this globalized world in which everything is connected, in which you can do business and manufacture from one end of the planet to the other, and you can send billions of dollars around the planet with a push of a button, but we all still live in communities and we care about the welfare of those communities.
All right, let's clear up some definitions right away. To a lot of people, once they moved beyond a 56K modem, they were on broadband. They have DSL at home or cable, maybe they have a T1 at work. Is that your definition of broadband or what is it?
Well, I like to have a broad definition of broadband, sure. I think it starts at, you know, probably 200K. But the world is redefining for America what broadband should be. You see various published average speeds over here of 5 megabits per second, which I don't believe for a second. I'm in the metro area. I've got some pretty good connectivity. But if you go to Europe, if you go to Asia, it's kind of unbelievable. They are getting 6, 7, 8 megabits in their homes. In Japan, I think their average offer is 100 megabits per second for about $30, the equivalent of $30 or $40 a month. So they have put in place the policies that have made it possible to build out really robust broadband offerings. And we've just been sort of ignoring the issue and assuming that we were ahead here in the States.
Who put those policies in place? Is it a political thing? Is it the businesses?
No, it's largely political. It's been some smart policy setting. The South Koreans led the way, kind of showed the way. The government decided that they were going to, well, you can do this in South Korea because they have kind of a top-down government, but the government basically said, we're going to have lots of broadband, we're going to license multiple competitors, we're going to tell them very forcefully the price needs to be at the same price as dial-up. And companies all sprang up and started building like mad, and they did indeed do it. Now, a couple of the companies went bankrupt in the process because it became a very, very tough market, but the net result has been a public good, and the companies that survive are, as far as I know, doing extremely well. Europeans, similar thing. There you had an interesting situation because in Europe, the telephone companies were all owned by the national governments, which created a great conflict of interest. National governments make money in telecom. They first privatized those companies, and then they put in some pretty robust, in most countries, they put in some pretty robust competition rules. And it took time. I mean, nobody really knows how to break up a monopoly and do it well. We've tried in the States, and now we've come back around to where we have basically two big bell companies running most of the show, instead of one big bell company running most of the show. But they've done some very effective work overseas, and as a result, they've got it better than we do right now.
For the U.S. to catch up, what would be the first steps?
I think the first step would be for somebody on the national level to notice that we need a broadband policy. I mean, I just recently, this week, saw a statement from one of the FCC commissioners lamenting the fact that there was no national broadband policy. I kind of thought, well, that's interesting. I thought that might be your job. From the president, there are bills in Congress, apparently. People are beginning to take stabs at this. But just the idea that we haven't had a strong national message that says there will be universal broadband coverage in the United States and it will be done on this date, I don't think that's beyond our capability. And then after that, we have some interesting challenges because telecom regulation in the U.S. is balkanized. It's not on the state level. And so in each state, there's all the political factors that go into this. In 7 states in the United States, for instance, it's illegal for a municipality to deliver telecommunication services because the telecos in those states got to the public utility commissions early and got the rules put in place. In some 30 states, there's some form of restriction or other. I only mention that not because the government ought to be a service provider, but in a lot of markets, the local government is the only alternative service provider. And so you take away competition, and guess what happens? You know, people don't invest when they don't feel competitive pressure. And I have, you know, by the way, I'm not one of the people who's dismissive of the telephone industry. I think they have a job, and it's to make a return on their investment. The public good is not necessarily always served best by that, but that's their job, and those are the rules.
So you don't see something drastic like where the government says, for the good of the community, we're going to take over this connectivity.
The record on nationalization or I guess localization is terrible. You know, government is not, nobody wants government to be a service provider except in areas where there's no alternative. They serve different interests. What seems to be very powerful is the kind of model you're seeing actually right here, starting right here in Cleveland with one community. What they did was to, and it's one of the reasons they're among our top 7 intelligent communities, they found a way through the thicket. On the one side, you have telecommunications industry with some level of competition wanting to invest where it can get a good return. On the other side, you have government wanting a public good. One community came in and said, well, we have an interesting idea. Why don't we see if we can't... it was an opportunistic idea. It was timing. They started this work when the telecom industry entered a terrible recession and had just finished putting a tremendous amount of fiber optic cable into the ground, which was all sitting there unused because there wasn't the demand. So one community did a very creative bit of deal-making. As a nonprofit, it convinced a bunch of carriers to donate unused fiber capacity in exchange for the revenues they would get by hooking people up to it, hooking one community member organizations up. And that was, you know, driven by Case Western, led by Lev Gonick, their CIO, by the Cleveland Clinic, by city government, by the school districts, and you know, major institutional players in the community. And boy, it worked out for everybody. The carriers got revenue that they weren't going to get otherwise. The institutions involved got lower cost, far more robust and faster broadband service. One community got the beginning of a really interesting existence in promoting the economy of the area based upon broadband.
You know, to many people still think of municipal broadband as free Wi-Fi. We've seen that in several cities and across the U.S. How is it more than that, and what should it be?
Well, it's a complicated. Let's unpack that a little bit. There's a lot of headlines about, you know, is Muni Wireless dead? And I always enjoy the articles because they're always the same. The articles start out with a headline that says, you know, it's all over for Muni Wireless. And then you read the article, and it starts out by talking about the flameouts. Earthlink is the villain of the piece. They convinced several cities that they could build out a network for them and do it for free. And the city said, gee, how nice. And apparently nobody ever told them about a free lunch. So what Earthlink discovered was that it costs more and takes longer, and they couldn't, at the end of the day, make a business case. So they said, well, the only way we're going to do this is if you co-invest with us. And that's the point at which the city said no. Now, Muni Wireless in other areas is working out just fine, thank you, if it has a decent business case. In many cases, cities are risk-sharing because they're able to make a public sector argument. They say, let's put in a wireless network. We're going to run key public services over it, like first responder services. And we're going to save money doing that because we don't no longer have to buy service in some places. And we're going to deliver a public good at the same time. And that ends up being a win-win. To go back to your core question, you know, is it just Muni Wireless? Well, you know, the answer is no. First of all, Wi-Fi is a perfectly good technology, but it's certainly not the be-all and end-all. It's got short range. It's got limited capacity. One of the things that people don't know about wireless networks is at the end of the day, they're actually wired networks because all those wireless nodes have to plug into something. So one of the things that I say to many, many communities as I'm talking to them is, let's not get too excited about which flavor of technology we're going to put into place. The key issue is, what do you want to do with it? You want to just have Wi-Fi in your parks? Okay, that's nice. I have never to this day been able to figure out why anybody puts Wi-Fi into a public park. I've never seen anybody using a laptop in one. But, you know, I know why they do it, because it's easy. I mean, they own the park, they own the light poles, it's done. But that's, you know, so many of those projects, in my opinion, end up being demonstration projects. They're ways of saying, hey, we're tech savvy. I don't know if they reflect really good thinking about how to accomplish a public.
Okay, the Intelligent Community Forum has a top 7 Intelligent Communities Award you're going to be announcing in May. First of all, how do you define community? Is there a size limit or a geographical limit? And then what makes them intelligent by your standards?
Very good question. Our definition of community is deliberately broad. I guess if I had to define it, I'd say it's a contiguous region. It's a region that's all one piece, where people perceive it as being a unit. So, you know, it can, in some cases, we've defined a nation as a community. Singapore, the island of Singapore, is a big city, but it's also a nation. In other cases, it's an individual. You know, it's the municipal boundaries of one of our top 7, Fredericton, New Brunswick, in Canada. It's the municipal boundaries of Waterloo, Ontario, which is our current Intelligent Community of the Year, the home of Research in Motion that makes the BlackBerry. But in other cases, it'll be city regions. The Westchester County is also on our list because they operate as an entity. They think of themselves as an economic unit, and I think the same is true of this region. So, how do you get there? How do you be intelligent? An intelligent community is one that is, I think, as I said at the beginning, is using information technology and broadband to develop its economy. And that's a very complex thing to do. And our focus at ICF is we're interested in the creation of income and wealth in communities in this incredibly challenging time. And we're interested in it, whether it's a large community or a small one, if it's in the industrialized world, the developing world. They all have different issues, but they all face very similar challenges. If I may, I'll just take a second to talk about this. I mean, the world has undergone this incredible transformation of connectivity, where today you can export capital with the push of a button, you can export jobs, and of course we do. You can import skills, and we do. And that has created a world in which the ability to use your hands to make a living is basically vanishing in the industrialized nation. And we've all seen this, that the minimum skill level to earn a living wage is rising relentlessly. And how are we going to adapt to that? What intelligent communities are doing is finding out that they can use broadband as the next highway, the next rail line, the next seaport or airport that brings economic opportunity to them. And if you're a community, broadband does a large number of very exciting things for you. It makes it possible for your small to mid-sized companies to become global exporters. And there's example after example of this. It enables your people to gain access to the world's knowledge, whether they're adults or children. It enables your people to gain access to a global collection of vendors delivering low-cost, high-quality services to you. It enables you to use web-based tools to actually pull your community closer together. And there's some great examples right here in the Northeast Ohio region. So intelligent communities are taking advantage of all of these opportunities rather than sitting there and letting the economic dislocation just run right over them. And that's what we see here in the Northeast Ohio region.
You've been listening to the Great Lakes Geek Show. Come back soon at www.greatlakesgeek.com.